Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the women who has been really in the front lines of that war for decades. In fact, since she came from Cuba seeking freedom in this country, is our first guest, Congresswoman Eliana Ross-Leighton, a woman I've had the privilege of knowing and working with for many years and have admired greatly. She is Chairman Emeritus of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs and now serves as the chairman of its subcommittee on the Middle East and North Africa. And her contributions to this country have been considerable, but I want to talk after saying, first of all, welcome back, Eliana Ross-Leighton. It's great to have you with us. Happy New Year to you, and thank you for joining
us. Well, Happy New Year, Frank. I'm so glad that I'm in Miami and you're in D.C. I'm sorry for you, but
we're
having a cold front. It's going to get to 60.
Well, it will be one of these things that we wish we were there. That's for sure. And glad you're not being subjected to it here. But Eliana, I do want to say we don't often get to talk about good news on this program. I'm sorry to say an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world turns out to have a lot of bad news in it, as you know. But talk a little bit about a very signal accomplishment in which you played no small role when UNESCO, the UN agency that purports to be about promoting education and culture and the like in the international arena, was seeking additional funding from the United States government in violation of U.S. law.
Absolutely. And I want to thank all the listeners who helped make sure that we would eliminate the funding for UNESCO, because grassroots activism really makes a difference. And you, Frank, played an important role in that as well. But as we know, UNESCO opted. It was their decision to grant Palestine, a non-existent state, membership to its rank in October of 2011. And they did so knowing full well that U.S. law mandated that we would have to cut off funding for UNESCO. But they figured, oh, this is the Obama administration and the squishes in Congress. They're going to give us the money. And in fact, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, met with members of our Foreign Affairs Committee and said, this is a priority of mine to make sure that we give UNESCO flexibility and that we give it the money. So they were going not only for $80 million in U.S. funding, your taxpayer dollars going to UNESCO, but also $250 million in late fees, because we had not been paying our dues. Why? Because it is in violation of the law.
Right.
Well, it was in the budget bill that was just approved last week.
This is the omnibus appropriations bill.
Absolutely, Frank. And it was only because of the pressure from grassroots that we were able to take it out. It was one of the last edits to the bill, and the money was there. So don't think that the battle is now over, because they're going to continue with this. And remember that any vote to restore any U.S. funding for UNESCO would not only undermine our credibility, it would set a dangerous precedent. Every agency would then do it, admit Palestine, and it would further embolden an already intransigent Abu Mazen and the Palestinian Authority, where they say they're never going to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. So if we concede to UNESCO, if we restore any funding, we would be making a grave mistake and wasting hundreds of millions of dollars of the constituents' tax dollars on this anti-U.S., anti-Israel agenda. And remember, this is the same UN, Frank, that allows, who sits on the Human Rights Committee? Cuba, China, Venezuela,
Iran,
Syria, Iran. I mean, this
Saudi
is unbelievable.
Arabia.
And Iran was picked to chair a disarmament committee. It's just incredible. So UNESCO must not receive a dime until it can take the money if it reverses its decision on Palestine and undertake some drastic reforms. So we were able to stop it thanks to everybody who helped out on this. Don't think that the battle is over. They will be back. They call it flexibility. That means that they're getting their hands in your pocket.
Well, I want to commend to everyone your floor statement on the House of Representatives on January 9th, 2014, where you took up this cudgel and you made it very clear that not only would this funding, if it had been included in the omnibus appropriations bill, as not only the administration saw it, but also, the elders in your own institution, you would have not only seen American law violated, as we said, but also, as you indicated, an open season on the part of every international organization to rush to defy our law as well.
Absolutely. And you know, this is an interesting thing about what happened. Just this past weekend, UNESCO announced that it was canceling an exhibit that it had planned to hold in France on the connection between Jewish people and the land of Israel. It was a very pro-Israel exhibit. But they said, no, we're canceling them because this exhibit will harm the peace negotiations. Well, this was just a retaliation against not getting U.S. funding, but it shows that it continues with this anti-U.S. and anti-Israel agenda. We should not fund UNESCO, and let's make sure that we do this each and every time.
Well, the interesting thing about that, as you say, Eliana Rosletin, is that the guys so cynically thought that they could be portraying themselves as friends of Israel by putting together this exhibit when their record is so
It was such a sham.
Yeah.
And then as soon as we pulled the rug from under them, they said, okay, no exhibit.
It's over the side. Let me turn to another subject that's near and dear to your heart, I know, and that you're also very actively engaged in, Congressman Rosletin. And you are, as I mentioned earlier, chairing the Middle East Subcommittee of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House. Talk a bit about the Iran deal that President Obama has struck. It eases sanctions. I think it unravels sanctions. There is an effort, and I know you're right at the forefront of this, on the part of members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, both sides of the Hill, to try to refurbish, reestablish, rebuild those sanctions.
Well, this is a bad deal. We should continue with sanctions. I'm the author of the toughest sanctions bill, that laws that are on the books, and this administration has not implemented those sanctions. So we're going to file a bill to force them to implement what we already have and try to get them to pass new sanctions. But I believe that this bill is a problem because this nuclear deal with Iran, it jeopardizes our national security. It jeopardizes the security of our ally, the Democratic Jewish State of Israel. It endangers the safety of all of our interests, and it does very little to prevent Iran from being nuclear capable. So we've got to, I mean, there's just basic things that any agreement needs to do, and this one doesn't do it. Dismantle the existing centrifuges. This doesn't do it. Stop its uranium enrichment program, which is only to be an aggressor, and give up its ICBM program and allow unfettered, unannounced access to its military sites. But, Frank, we have set the bar so low with this deal that every 6 months we will be applauding this deal as saying, look, Iran has met all of the goals. Yes, because they're at the kindergarten level. So I fully expect Iran to comply with everything in this bad deal because the bar is so low. It is lower than U.S. law. It is lower than the U.N. Security Council. Of course they will comply, but people have got to know that when we start applauding Iran for complying, it's at a very dangerously low level. So don't applaud. Hold this administration's feet to the fire. Force them to really apply the tough sanctions and stop them from releasing all of this aid. These sanctions have held up so much money from Iran that we've crippled their economy. That's what's been successful. And now this administration has just opened up the spigot and said, okay, here you go. All of the money is coming your way. And, use it wisely, and we trust you. Everything is just going to go so well. It's amazingly obscene, and I'm very much against this plan. When we look at the schedule for the money, Frank, it should give everyone real pause about what is going to be happening. February 1st is the first installment, $550 million to Iran. March 1st, $450 million. March 7th, $550 million. April 10th, $550 million. I mean, that could just keep
staggering.
Going installment
yep.
by installment.
$7 billion easily.
Absolutely.
And then $20 billion, some say, by the time the 6 months is over. Congressman Rose-Layton, we've got to let you go. There's so much more to talk about, and I hope that we'll have a chance to do so again in the future. Your portfolio in the Foreign Affairs Committee just runneth over, I guess is the expression, between Syria and John Kerry's peace process, what's happening in Egypt, Benghazi Gate, and on and on.
Yeah,
your,
we've got a lot to talk about.
Your leadership is deeply appreciated, and I hope that you'll visit with us again very
Let's
soon.
Let's do it. Please invite me.
Keep up the good work. Count on it. Next up, Gordon Chang on the economic and strategic implications of a mega default in China. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change your minds.
They're not going to change your minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
On August 2nd, 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
Debbie Lee became a Gold Star mom that day.
And it started a lifelong mission of her own. In Mark's honor, Debbie founded America's Mighty Warriors,
dedicated to supporting the troops and their families.
AMW educates the public through speaking engagements, rallies, and events to raise awareness and appreciation of our military.
AMW advocates for the troops.
Funding, rules of engagement, benefits. AMW is committed to being a voice for justice for our troops. AMW serves Gold Star families. Retreats, concerts, special events.
Good things to remind the families they're not forgotten.
America's Mighty Warriors.
Nonprofit.
Dedicated to the troops and their families.
Donations are tax deductible.
Log on to americasmightywarriors.org.
Find out how you can help.
The best of America deserves our best. Log on today.
americasmightywarriors.org.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, our duty expert on matters involving Asia and our interests there, which are considerable. He is one of the country's preeminent authorities on the subject, a columnist on it, and related subjects at Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com. He is also a regular at Fox News, one of their go-to guys, as he is ours. We're very pleased to have him with us each week. Welcome back, Gordon. Good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank.
We spoke last week, Gordon, about a piece of the China puzzle that I think has gotten very little attention in most Western circles. Certainly, it was not something I had been paying much mind to, namely water problems in China. Talk a little bit about the subject of a piece you had in the World Affairs Journal recently about how that's manifesting itself perhaps in connection with problems it's having in neighboring Burma, where it's been trying to build dams that presumably would provide it some water as well.
China is trying to export its Three Gorges Dam to Burma, and it is unpopular in Burma as it is in China, actually even more so. And the reason is that it's going to flood some very historical areas. One of them is considered to be the birthplace of Burma. It's going to displace tens of thousands of ethnic Kachin minorities. And it's also going to basically destroy the Burmese environment. And so the Burmese government in September 2011 suspended work on the Chinese-sponsored dam. And what did Beijing do? Well, the important thing for us is that it didn't blame the Burmese government. It blamed the United States. And this is, I think, symptomatic of what we're seeing in a number of different areas where essentially Beijing is going after Washington for its own problems. Whether you're talking about the economy, the South China Sea, or a dam in Burma, it's all our fault.
I guess this sort of plays into a theme that we talk about most weeks, which is the likelihood that China will find social engineering, as they call it, in authoritarian circles to foster this notion of nationalism by promoting this idea that there are external enemies, including us, to justify continued authoritarian control at home. Gordon, this comes at a moment when the Washington Times reported last Friday that Admiral Samuel Locklear, the commander of U.S. forces in the Pacific, was basically acknowledging that we are losing dominance in the Western Pacific to China. Not exactly a revelation to many of us, but it's the first time, I think, at least that I can recall, a senior military officer or, for that matter, U.S. government official has recognized that reality. Tie these two together for us, if you would, the growing assertiveness of China and this the seeming anti-Americanism. What does it portend?
Well, basically, Beijing wants to drive the United States out of the Western Pacific, and it's becoming undeniable that the Navy's assets are maybe not up to the challenge. Now, many people will disagree with that, but the point is that the U.S. is losing its dominance. And one of the important things about that Locklear interview is essentially he says that China should be providing security in the region. That's absolutely wrong. China is not a provider of security except to Beijing itself. It is threatening neighbors from, you know, South Korea, Japan, Vietnam, the Philippines. This is really an important story, and the United States needs to come to the party. We need to understand and to be able to say in public what the threat in Asia is. It's not global warming, as he so famously said about a year ago. It is the Chinese belligerence.
I'm reminded, Gordon, of a comment. I think I may have shared it with you before, but I think it bears repeating, by Mark Helprin in one of our programs earlier in the year. He described kind of the trajectory we seem to be on as one in which initially we respond to the Chinese military buildup by saying, well, they don't have the quantity of naval assets and other systems that we do, and then they do. And then we console ourselves by saying, well, they don't have the quality of naval and other assets that we do. And then they seem to be getting that. And then we begin trying to accommodate ourselves to the new reality that it's too late to do anything about the rising threat posed by China. But you've put your finger on something that we're doing that's very worrying, and that is kind of downplaying it or trying to accommodate it. In the case of Locklear saying, China, come on in and provide security in our absence. Very troubling stuff. And strategically, I would think being read by China is further evidence that the United States is indeed a waning power, and their day has come.
Well, you know, the thing about the United States is that there is always going to be a concern about how much we can afford, and that's a very big issue. But the one thing we can afford to do, doesn't cost anything, is to basically tell the truth. And that's important because, you know, it also erodes our relations with China to the extent that we have them, because the Chinese see that we are not being transparent with them. We always say they've got to be transparent with the world. Well, unfortunately, we're not being transparent with them because we know that they're the threat, but we're not willing to say it. When Beijing sees that, it sends two very bad messages. They think that we're devious, And also, they believe that we have no will. So this is really two vital wounds that we're inflicting on ourselves, and completely unnecessary.
Yeah, unnecessary and deeply problematic, I think, in every sense of the word. Gordon, let me turn to something else that you've written about at Forbes.com in your column there. And again, our guest is Gordon Chang. He is a regular columnist for Forbes and a regular contributor to this program. You talk about a mega default that is looming in China by the 31st of January. Talk a bit about what is specifically happening with respect to this particular transaction and whether it portends a much larger danger for the Chinese economy and what it might mean for ours.
Well, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, which is the world's largest bank, marketed a wealth management product that was put together by another trust company. And essentially what's going on here is that Chinese investors are trying to chase yields, to try to find places where they can get more on their return, more for their money than bank deposits. And this wealth management product lent money to a coal miner in Shaanxi province, which is failing or already failed, according to some reports. And so people are worried that the failure of, and this will be the first failure of a wealth management product in China. There's about $1.6, $1.7 trillion worth of these dodgy investments. And people are worried that the Chinese financial system could fail when this wealth management product defaults on the 31st. People are starting to say, well, you know, maybe it's good that there be a failure to teach Chinese investors a lesson. And there's a lot to say about that. But if the People's Bank of China, the central bank, lets things get out of hand, we could see a failing financial system in a couple weeks after the Chinese New Year holiday ends.
Wow. And your Forbes column, Gordon, was very interesting in terms of your depiction of how the Chinese bureaucracy has kind of tried to manage these things in the past and perhaps staved off the day when this kind of reckoning takes place. You characterize this as a China heading, quote, towards catastrophic failure, unquote. That surely means something not just for the Chinese, but perhaps for us as well. Do you forecast real problems for the U.S. economy and, for that matter, the international trading system if this thing goes seriously bad?
Well, there probably will be a catastrophic failure in China. Maybe not on January 31st, but eventually, because the Chinese government is preventing the adjustments and corrections that need to occur. And this will have an effect on us because we misunderstand what's going on in China. We tend to look at China in very different ways, very much divorced from reality. If we understood what was going on in China, their failure, which will come, would not affect us too much. But unfortunately, we're misperceiving the situation there. We think they're an engine of global growth. They're not. We think that they're important for the global economy. Yes, they are, but not in the ways that we think. And so essentially, if we understood things better, then we would be able to better weather the inevitable failure of the Chinese economy.
Again, it comes back to telling the truth and being realistic. Gordon Chang will be following this story closely, as I know will you, at Forbes.com, World Affairs Journal, and Fox News. We'll talk with you again next week. In the meantime, thank you very much for joining us. Next up, Andy McCarthy on the president's latest example of national security fraud. Straight ahead.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
This is Frank Afty with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, the Obama administration eased sanctions on Iran in exchange for a symbolic pause in parts of the mullah's nuclear weapons program. Covert facilities around the country have not slowed their operations, let alone stopped them. Even those facilities the Iranians actually declared and opened to international inspection have not been appreciably impacted by the New Deal. The regime estimates that it would take just days to reverse the interim agreement's effects on its nuclear program. What Iran gains from the deal will be very hard to undo, however. Sanctions have not just been eased, they are unraveling, with $7 billion turned over to Tehran up front and much more in prospect. Worse, the region knows the Iranians will get the bomb, and more nations will do the same. Some deal. This is Frank Afney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Andy McCarthy. He is one of the guys that makes this show, I think, must listening. He is our friend from National Review Online and Pajamas Media, where he writes marvelous columns. He is also a former federal prosecutor who put away the blind sheik and his co-conspirators, something for which we will always be grateful. He's also the author of numerous best-selling and absolutely marvelous books, including most recently Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy. And I want to talk a little bit about that with you in a moment. The illusion carries on. But Andy, first, speaking of illusions, how about that presidential address about the National Security Agency? You have unburdened yourself of some rather strong views on the subject. Do so again, please.
Well, thank you, Frank. President Obama is just mind-boggling at times. And it's not just because he says things like he did in that speech lauding our traditions of the Constitution and limited government, which about knocked me flat out of my chair. But I think, as I stressed in what I wrote, the problem with the president is that he doesn't take his job as seriously as he should. And, maybe he ought to go to one or two fewer fundraisers or just play the front nine some days do things like give a speech about the NSA, where he articulates how badly we need the program for purposes of our security, but do it 6 or 7 months ago when it actually would have made a difference in terms of what the narrative people have accepted about the program is. And while it was being vilified in such a way that the American people have a very contorted understanding of what the NSA is actually doing.
And this contortion has prompted many to believe that there is wholesale invasion of Americans' privacy. And it really set the predicate for the sorts of things that the president said he was going to do to address those concerns. Talk a little bit, Andy, about what you made of his proposals, and would they do anything to address privacy concerns, or more to the point, what would they do to national security intelligence collection capabilities that we may just need in a pretty dangerous world?
Yeah, I'd say, Frank, that the bottom line is the president's speech does nothing to advance privacy concerns, which were fully taken care of in the design of the program in the first place. He endangers national security because this is a program that we need, and he says that notwithstanding that the program is both legal and legitimately and properly implemented and administered, he's going to change it anyway, even though he was a little bit dodgy about what the change would entail. So here's the problem. I mean, basically, he doesn't step up to the plate when you need the president to step up to the plate, namely when the program was being broadly criticized from extremists on the left, extremists on the libertarian side, who have convinced people that the NSA is actually spying on Americans. I mentioned in the piece that I wrote that when I speak to audiences about this, I find that almost nobody realizes that even their names are not in this database, that it's just telephone numbers. There's no identifying information that connects up the phone numbers. But little basic things like that, elemental pieces of information that would make a big difference to people's understanding of the program, need to be communicated by the president. And he was AWOL when we needed him to step up and defend this thing. And now he's taken the position that the program is fine, legal, implemented properly, protect your rights, and we're going to change it anyway. And by the way, I'll get back to you at the end of March on how that's all going to happen.
After one of the guys that you've been covering with great effect for a long time, Eric Holder, finishes trying to figure it out. And Andy, I guess, you know, we've been talking about, inspired in no small measure by some of your ruminations on the subject, fraud that's been perpetrated by the president. National security fraud is of particular concern to me, and I can't think of really a more vivid example of it than the president announcing, as he did in this address at the Department of Justice on Friday, that we're going to begin transitioning immediately some of these so-called Section 215 programs, but we don't know what we're going to transition them to.
Right.
And won't, and in fact are ruling out the obvious alternatives for good reason, frankly.
Yeah, I'm reminded of what was that big movie in the I can't remember, with Marlon Brando I guess it was Apocalypse Now, where they, you know, they spent a kajillion dollars on the movie and they filmed 3 or 4 different endings because they couldn't figure out how it should come out. And when you watch the movie, it certainly looked like they couldn't figure out.
It certainly did.
This is life and death, not just movie about life and death. And you're quite right. We're talking about making a drastic change, at least rhetorically we're talking about making a drastic change. At the moment, the drastic change only seems to be on the side of giving privacy rights to non-Americans, which is itself astounding. That's sort of the other half of what he did. But with respect to the metadata program, you know, he's talking about significant changes, not really telling us what they are, because you can tell that they just haven't figured them out yet.
Andy, speaking of the privacy thing, I do want to come to that momentarily, because you and I were just discussing off air that growing concern about what is going on in Turkey. And it's, frankly, it's been a concern for some time because of the Islamization of that country that has been taking place under Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the prime minister. He strikes me as a perfect example of the kind of foreign leader who is nominally a friend and ally. In fact, President Obama says he's one of his closest friends among his counterparts, who we ought to have NSA on full time. Because this is a guy who's working with the enemy full time, whether it's Iran or Al-Qaeda or the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, at the very least, I would say even if the NSA was not on him all the time, he ought to be worried that they're on him all the time. That in and of itself might have an ameliorating effect on his conduct. But of course, that's not going to be the case. And if you take a long view on this, as we who've been involved in this debate over foreign intelligence collection for the last decade, because it really has been going on that long, think of where we've gone here. I mean, the whole idea of getting the courts involved in the first place was that American citizens inside the United States ought to have constitutional protections that were analogous to what they have in the criminal justice system, even though when you're talking about national security, the underlying assumptions are different. We're not talking about people presumed innocent of crimes. We're talking about national security protection for the country against extraneous threats. And what everybody said when this novelty of getting the courts involved first started was, you know, look, we're not touching what goes on outside the United States. Obviously, the intelligence community has to be aggressive there. People outside the United States don't have the expectation of protections under our Constitution. Now we're giving those people who don't have the obligations of citizenship, many of whom are hostile to our country, cognizable, judicially enforceable rights under our law, even though they have no claim to any rights under the Constitution, which is what is supposed to have gotten this whole thing started in the first place.
It is extraordinary, Andy, and I think that this is a place where, again, your legal expertise as well as seemingly a corporate memory that is almost unique at the moment is so valuable. We're looking at a fundamental transformation of American intelligence capabilities, if only because a lot of targets will be taken off the list, evidently. And honestly, I can't for the life of me figure out if you're extending this sort of protection to what the president called ordinary citizens, how you're going to know that you're not missing people who masquerade as ordinary citizens like those of Al-Qaeda and its Islamist friends. Anyway, unfortunately, we are out of time to pursue that. I look forward to doing so with you at greater length, including a visit about what's happening with Turkey and the new Egyptian constitution and much, much more in the days ahead. Thank you for all that you've done for our country and are continuing to do and for joining us each week. Next up, the fabulous Catherine Herridge of Fox News joins us to talk about getting to the bottom of Benghazi Gate. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney.
My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Catherine Herridge. She is one of the rock stars of Fox News who has been doing extraordinarily important work covering national security beats. She is their chief intelligence correspondent, and she and Jennifer Griffin in particular have been really all over and helping the rest of us understand what's been going on in connection with the story of Benghazi. And Catherine, I'm very pleased to have you with us. First of all, say Happy New Year to you. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, as always.
And thank you, too, for this incredible reporting you've been doing. I'd like to get your thoughts quickly on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report. Did you find that it provided the kind of accountability that we've all been looking for, and you've been doing so much to help create a climate demanding?
I think this report was a seminal report in the Benghazi investigation because it was the first bipartisan report that really laid out where the failings were leading up to Benghazi. And I think it has real teeth. It's very explicit as to the parties who were involved. It names members of two official al-Qaeda affiliates in North Africa, as well as this group Ansar al-Sharia, which is led by a former Guantanamo detainee, and a group in Egypt called the Jamal Network. This is a group whose leader has been in contact with Amin al-Zawahiri in Pakistan. So I think, at least in that frame, the report very much validates the reporting that we have been doing at Fox News. I would say in isolation that this was an al-Qaeda-led event.
Yeah, very much contradicting the kind of reporting that we got out of the New York Times recently, in which they insisted that there was no evidence, in fact, that al-Qaeda was involved at all. I haven't spoken with you since that report came out. Your thoughts on it, as well as we'll talk more in a moment about the rest of the contents of this report, but just on what was going on with the New York Times?
Well, I can't speak for the New York Times, but if you take that report and you balance it against the findings of the Senate Intelligence Report, which is bipartisan and I would say considered politically neutral, the central findings of the New York Times just do not stand up. Firstly, that there was no al-Qaeda presence in Benghazi at that time. The report specifically states that members of al-Qaeda affiliates took part in the attack. And it also points specifically to a State Department cable. We were first to review this classified cable in October of 2012, so 1 month after the attack. And that cable was really, Frank, the smoking gun warning. It summarized an emergency action committee meeting in Benghazi between the State Department and the CIA, and it went to the office of then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And
when was this, Catherine?
This was this emergency meeting was in August of 2012. It was 1 month before the attack. And when I first reviewed this cable in October of 2012, it was brought to me by a whistleblower. It eerily foreshadowed how these people would die. It warned Washington that the conflict could not sustain a coordinated assault. It also warned Washington in black and white that there were 10 Islamist and al-Qaeda training camps within Benghazi, and it said that they specifically needed more help or they would have to at least temporarily close down and co-locate with the CIA at the annex in Benghazi. And I had the opportunity to interview the ranking Republican on the Senate committee who, interestingly enough...
That would be Saxby Chambliss, right?
That's correct. He told me that this was the one document that the State Department resisted until the 11th hour of providing to the Senate Intelligence Committee. So I think this tells you the importance of the document. And it is a document that Mrs. Clinton said in her testimony had never been brought to her attention, which is striking because it was brought to everyone else's attention who had an interest in the region. So the defense secretary, the chairman of the Joint Chief, the head of the Africa Command, Carter Ham, they were all read in on this cable because it was considered so important. So, you know, in a nutshell with the New York Times, if you just look at the Senate report, you don't even look at the other reporting that is out there. It completely conflicts with this finding of a bipartisan a panel. Al-Qaeda was in Benghazi. This was an al-Qaeda-led event, and the intelligence and the documents specifically state as such.
And Catherine, with respect to this emergency meeting, I have a working hypothesis, which we've talked about before, that one of the people in Hillary's immediate circle who for sure would have been involved in these kinds of fulminations would have been Homa Abedin. Is there any evidence that what was going on in terms of the official resistance of the State Department to closing down even temporarily this consulate and now to providing this memo about the emergency action meeting really had some kind of, authorization, checkoff approval from the secretary's own personal office, if not she herself?
I think you're going to a very important question here. I can't speak to Huma Abedin and any kind of connection to the cable, but what I can say is that none of the investigations so far have answered the most basic of questions, which is who set the policy to be in eastern Libya with security that did not meet the prescribed standards within the State Department. And this is a decision that can only be taken at the most senior levels of the State Department. And this is not even a decision that could be taken by Undersecretary Patrick Kennedy. It would have to go, as they say, to the seventh floor, which is the executive floor, which is Mrs. Clinton's office. And I think when you answer that policy question, I think that you, in effect, solve the puzzle that is Benghazi, because everything follows from that. And this Emergency Action Committee and the cable in August of 2012, which was so important, it had distribution to the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the head of the Africa Command, but for whatever reason never reached Mrs. Clinton, this really does not pass the smell test.
The smell test, indeed. It stinks to high heavens, in other words. And I couldn't agree with you more, Catherine, and I hope that you will continue to be pursuing this. And again, our guest is Catherine Herridge of Fox News, their intelligence correspondent, because I think you're absolutely right. The policy that got us in there, the policy that had Chris Stevens there on that day, as well as the policy that resisted the kinds of prudent steps that were being called for repeatedly. It's the crux of the matter.
If I may, just to keep it very simple for listeners, I think what this may come down to in the end was a resistance to the facts on the ground, because it was not in keeping with the view that the administration's policy in Libya had been a success. In fact, the facts on the ground undercut that belief and showed that the policy had not been a success, at least in the short term. It had been a failure because it had created this opening for the Islamist groups. And as we now know from the documents, Al-Qaeda, specifically in Libya. So again, it's a resistance to the facts on the ground. And the Senate report shows without any doubt that there were multiple intelligence assessments leading up to the attack, that something was coming and that Al-Qaeda was in Libya. And when the administration says they didn't have a specific warning, having read the Senate report, the only thing that could have been more specific was an email with time, place, and method of attack. And that's just not how things work.
From Al-Qaeda. Quickly, and I know you've got to go, but Catherine, this is so helpful and so important. One other thing that the committee found rather categorically was that the video did not play a role
Correct.
In this attack. Mm-hmm. Could you just speak quickly to that point, because you've wrestled with this for some time, too?
We were first to report on September 17th, based on an intelligence source on the ground in Libya, that there was no demonstration or protest that preceded the attack. We were very much out there on our own for some time, but that did turn out to be the case. About 3 months after Benghazi, I asked a social a data mining company that specializes in social media to see when the first reference to the video was in Libya. In the days leading up to the attack and after the attack. And this data mining company is able to look at messages in the original language and translate. And what they found is that the first reference to the video in Libya was a day after the attack, and it was a retweet of Russia Today. So the idea that the video had any role, the video was a non-entity, a non-presence in Libya. And to say otherwise is, again, is resisting the facts on the ground.
Well, you're being charitable. I call it national security fraud, and I'm afraid it's been perpetrated repeatedly now and serially. We'll be talking more about that, I hope, with you and others in the future. Catherine, thank you so much for the superb work you do at Fox. Keep it up. Come back to us soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.